Book of Devarim is not just a repetition of the Torah. I'll be discussing this, you know, in greater detail in the coming, I guess, weeks. It's interesting because it comes out in the summertime, so you don't learn it in yeshiva. Everybody's off. But it really establishes the whole framework of what Torah is about. It's very, very important. Because up until this point, you're just getting the narrative. You're just getting the description of what's taking place. For example, the fact that that God is going to gather the entire people together and give them the Torah at Sinai. I said, that's just told to us in Shemos. We don't understand the reason for that. What's the reason? Why is it necessary to have the gathering at Sinai? And what is the significance of it? So Moshe revisits that whole issue. Now, it's important to study it. Study it as it's presented in Shemos, and study it as it's presented in Devarim. Much more information is being given in Devarim. So I'm not going to, you know, go into that right now. I'm just giving this as an example that there it's being presented as a historical fact. In Devarim, Moshe is explaining the reason for it and what we learn from it and why it's so important. So the book of Devarim is extremely, extremely important because it contains all of the hashkafa. That's in, everybody's familiar with the word hashkafa, I assume. The basic philosophy of life of Judaism is found more in the book of Devarim than in any other book of the Torah, in my opinion. I want to take up something in the last week's Sedra, the Sedra of Vayeschanan. Perhaps it'll help to illustrate what I'm talking about, that in this book, Moshe is not just talking about the rules and regulations of Judaism, he's not just talking about the mitzvot, but he is repeating. There are certain new mitzvot that are presented here, and Moshe Rabbeinu is revisiting some of the mitzvot that were already presented, but here it's being expressed in a different way. It's being expressed in the context of what the purpose is and what the nature of Torah is. What's the purpose of the Jewish people? And for example, a basic question: what's the purpose of the mitzvot? What's the benefit in doing the mitzvot? These are very, very significant issues, and to a large extent, I don't think that we study these things enough. I mean, people just are involved in doing the mitzvot. But what's the purpose? What's the philosophy behind it? What's the idea behind it? That is something which I think we really have to emphasize a little bit more. Now, let me just read to you. So Moshe says, the Ata Yisrael, and now Israel, Shema al Achukim v'al Mishpatim. Listen to the statutes and the ordinances, the laws, that I'm going to, Asher Anochi Melamed Eschem, that I'm going to teach you to do. So that's important. Two essential ideas, limud, learning, teaching, and doing. In order that you may live and come and inherit the land that the God of your fathers gives to you. Okay, that's the introduction. Now he says, lo tosifu al adavar, that you should not add to the Torah that I command you, that I'm commanding you, velo tigru mimenu, nor should you detract, subtract from it, to keep the mitzvos that the Lord your God, of the Lord your God, that I'm commanding you this day. All right, so here we have two commandments. So basically, these are two mitzvos. These are two mitzvos. We have to understand what it means. That is, it's a strange kind of a thought also, that Moshe is telling them that they shouldn't add to the mitzvos. Well, what does it mean, you shouldn't add to the mitzvos? Nor should you subtract from the mitzvos. You're not allowed to take away. What does it mean? What's the plain meaning of that? This is a prohibition. It's two of the 613 commandments. So it would seem that it's a command. You can't make up a new mitzvah of your own. You can't make up new practices. That's not included in the Torah. Nor can you subtract. You can't take away. Of course, we have to understand, you know, what kind of what is that addressing itself to? Why would a person want to add, and why would a person want to take away? For example, when we speak about diminishing, you can't diminish from the mitzvos. Well, either a person believes, if a person believes that the Torah comes from God, so he's, that's the way the Torah is, I don't think he's going to diminish. What kind of person are we talking about over here? If a person believes that the commandments don't come from God, so then is he going to diminish? He's not going to diminish. He's not going to keep the system. So, I mean, it would seem to me that that's the kind of questions I would ask. What kind of, who are we talking to? Well, once a person accepts the fact that it comes from God, that's really the challenge that the book talks about as well, that a person has to understand and shore up in his mind the reasons why we committed to the Torah, that the Torah comes from God. A person should know why it is that we're convinced that the Torah comes from God. But once you know that the Torah comes from God, so you're going to tell me I shouldn't add to it? Okay, well, what would I have thought otherwise? Why do I need Moshe to tell me this? Who would have the chutzpah? Who would have the chutzpah to add to the Torah? Who would have the chutzpah to take away, to detract, to diminish? Is that a good question? That happens to be true, that there are different branches of Judaism that, it seems to me, are caught up in a bit of a contradiction. They reserve the right to decide which we're going to maintain and which we're going to discard. I don't understand that. I can understand a person saying they're going to discard it because they don't believe that it's divine. If that's the case, so yeah, you can do whatever you please. But I don't think that Moshe is saying that. I don't think Moshe is addressing himself. I think Moshe over here is addressing himself to a person that really believes in the Torah. That's the only thing that makes sense to me. So we have to understand what the idea is. That's what we're going to try and understand. But before we do so, what comes next? Moshe continues with this thought, and he says, "You saw with your own eyes that which God did to Baal Peor. For every man that followed after Baal Peor, God destroyed him from our midst." So this is a reference to the incident that we read a few weeks ago. You're familiar with that? Is everybody familiar with the incident that took place? That was the idea, that was the advice of Bilam. That Bilam, who Balak had hired Bilam to, so to speak, curse the Jews. He really wanted him to give an etzah, advice, on how to undermine the Jewish people. So he couldn't succeed because God did not allow him to curse the Jews, so to speak. But in the end, he gave him some advice on how to undermine the Jews. And that's the story that we read right before Pinchas, that the women of the nation consorted with the men. Seduction. It was an unbelievable kind of a brilliant but evil kind of a strategy to break down the defenses, to commingle with the Jews, and ultimately to seduce them. And when they seduced them, they were able to pressure them into idolatry. That's what we did the story a few weeks ago. That was the strategy. And once they were committed to idolatry, so then God punished them. God brought down a plague upon them. So now Moshe, of course, then you had the incident of Pinchas. If you're familiar with the incident of Pinchas, that Pinchas intervened and brought the whole thing to an end. But before he was able to do that, there was a big tragedy. So Moshe now is referring to that, and he's saying, "You've seen with your own eyes that which God did in the matter of Baal Peor," that's the idol, "for every man that walked after, that followed in the footsteps of Baal Peor," that is, that clung to idolatry, "so God destroyed him from your midst. V'atem hadvekem b'Hashem Elokeichem." This is what we say when we take out the Torah, before the Kriyas HaTorah. But those of you who cling to the Lord your God, chayim kulchem hayom, you're all alive to this day. So I have two basic questions. What is the idea that Moshe is referring to over here about the not to add, not to detract? That's the first thing. And there's obviously a connection. In doing so, he's warning them to remember what took place in the matter of this incident, this terrible incident, where they allowed themselves to be seduced by the women, these strange women of the Midianites. And this led them into idolatry. So what does one thing have to do with the other? Because that took place, you shouldn't add and you shouldn't detract. There must be some type of a connection between the two. So those are the questions. Oh, thanks for the word. the basic fundamental idea over here is that we have to approach the Torah with a certain humbleness. Once you accept the fact that this is from a divine source. And of course, if you don't accept that, if you believe that it's man-made and then it's subject to evolution, so then I can understand that a person could say that, all right, that was the best thinking of the time, and there's progress, there's scientific progress, there's progress of knowledge, so then we can, so to speak, update the Torah. But if we believe, as we do, that the Torah is from God, so then this is an expression of God's infinite wisdom. So, but we have to be extremely humble about it. We have to study it very diligently. But a fundamental principle of Judaism is that the law of the Lord is perfect. This is perfect. That God worked it out in the most precise way. And that it's the most perfect system to govern mankind and to bring about the objective that, that God wanted to achieve with the giving of the Torah. And basically it means to say that if you try and change it, if you try and adapt it to the changing times, then you're just going to destroy it and you're going to make it impossible to achieve the objective. Now, before we go further, you'll notice, but don't we have more mitzvos? For example, Hanukkah is not in the Torah. Tisha B'Av is not in the Torah. Purim is not in the Torah. Not to mention that there's many laws that we observe on Shabbos that the rabbis instituted. Not to mention that with regard to kashrut, with regard to many areas, the rabbis added stringencies. You may be surprised to know that, for example, meat and milk. We don't eat... Yeah, chicken is not included.
No.
According to the Torah, chicken is not included.
Years ago they said it was like chicken and turkey were not even considered needed.
According to the Torah, the biblical requirement, there'd be no prohibition about having chicken or turkey. It's just, right.
But why did they do that now?
Not only that, even with regard to meat and milk, according to the Torah itself, the Torah only prohibits when they're cooked together, like a cheeseburger. So the idea of having at the same meal, having according to the Torah, if you had a glass of milk with a steak, then you haven't violated anything.
And this waiting.
And the waiting, many of these laws. Now I'm not going to go into it right now. Other than this is an illustration of the power that the Torah does give to the rabbis. The Torah, the rabbis have a power over here, which was given to them by the Torah, by God, to protect, to make a fence around the law. So you'll find many of the laws on Shabbos, for example, it's making a fence around the law. For example, there are 39 forms of work that you can't do on Shabbos. One of them would be like plucking a leaf off of a tree, you know, taking something from the place where it grows, or taking a fruit off of a tree. So that's the, if you do that with the intention because you want the fruit, so then you violated a biblical command. But the rabbis came along and made many protections to keep a person far away from the possibility, which we understand is necessary even to today. I mean, like you have to put covers over your, with the switch, so you shouldn't accidentally come in and forget. So we do have a tendency to forget. Excuse me, one second. So, for example, you're not allowed to ride a horse on Shabbos. Not that it means anything to anybody. The reason why you can't ride a horse on Shabbos is it's a decree, it's a rabbinic decree, because in those, if you rode a horse, so you need something to hit the horse, so you might pull off a branch. So it's one of those things.
Is that the reason?
No, I still like
you. As far as the idea that you're not allowed to work your animals on Shabbos, that is correct. But that's only if it's your own animal.
Well, what if it's your own horse?
Then you're right. Then you wouldn't need this prohibition. However, that would not prevent me from borrowing, from using somebody else's horse.
So you can't ride if it was your.
What I'm trying to say is like this: that there's one law. That's a biblical law, by the way. That if you have animals on Shabbos, even today, if you had a farm, or even a dog, and you've trained the dog to go out and get the paper or something. Let's say where there's no Eruv, where you're not allowed to carry it from inside. So you've trained your dog to go out and get the paper,
right.
So you can't do that on Shabbos, because that would be considered a form of work. So as far as that's concerned, I just want to, you know, summarize the point with the horse. You're right. that you would not be able to use your own animals to transport you places on Shabbos without this. You wouldn't need this decree. However, you would be permitted to use the horse of a non-Jew. That would not be under this.
But it can't be a
but now you can't. Now you can't. You can't do it regardless because they came along and said that riding the horse per se is prohibited because of a separate reason that you might forget yourself and pull off a branch to hit the horse. I'm just giving you an illustration. The answer is that this is rabbinic, but then, even though it's rabbinic, it does partake of being biblical because the question is by what authority? So the answer is that that God gave to Moshe Rabbeinu and was passed down from generation to generation that the leading rabbis, the masters, so to speak, of the oral law, have the right under certain guidelines. There are guidelines that pertain to what they can enact, what they can't enact, and so on. They have to take into consideration the state of the people. But once they make the enactment, then it is binding upon us from God because God empowered them. Even though God did not make this legislation, because God, like any system of law, has to be given over to people to ensure that it's being enforced properly. So if the people are on a very high level and they were keeping the law scrupulously, there would be no need for all of these rules and regulations, all of these fences. That's the way it is. Government is best that governs least. That is, when people are on a high level, you don't need so many rules and regulations. You see it with your own children, when you have your own children. If the kids are well disciplined, they've accepted the authority, they know what they have to do, so they go to sleep on time. You don't have to have 20 rules that a half hour before bedtime you have to put out the television. And then 29 minutes before you have to go brush your teeth. And then you don't have to do it because they're on a level where they're mature. But when people begin to take advantage, that's the way it is in any system. When people take advantage and they're looking for every loophole to escape the system, so then you have to have more rules and regulations. That's just a rough outline. Let me just... We also find, aside from fences, that the rabbis did enact what would seem to be a new mitzvah. For example, you have by Hanukkah. Hanukkah is not just a fence around protecting something. That's a whole new mitzvah to light a candle for 8 nights, and you make a blessing. And well, what is the blessing? Blessed art thou, Lord our God, creator of you, who commanded us. Who commanded us to light the Hanukkah light. Which is not the case, because God didn't command it. Because you don't find that in the Torah. So how can we say something like that God actually commanded us? You say the same thing when we read the Megillah. Blessed art thou, Lord our God, creator, right? Who commanded us, who sanctified us with his mitzvot, he commanded us to read the Megillah. But it's not true. God did not command us to read the Megillah. But this, of course, illustrates my point that it is at the commandment of God. That is, God commanded us to listen to those who he authorized to make these kinds of mitzvot, when they would see fit. And therefore, if a person violates a rabbinic command, he's violating God's law. It's as though God commanded us to do it. It's, for example, like the general. The general can make certain orders, his own, that come directly from him. But then the general says, and whatever my assistant, whatever, you know, the... Yeah. He's authorized, the captain. Whatever the captain tells you in this battle, I'm authorizing it, and you, by my authority, you have to keep it. So the rule then comes from the captain. He's the one who's formulating it, but the authority is the authority. You're violating the authority of the general. That's the same idea over here. However, I just want to mention that this is not the same as a fence around the law. So this would seem to be an addition. It's a new mitzvah. Shabbos already we have. You can't pull, that we understand. The Torah is saying you can't pull off leaves. Now they're just giving you a little, fence, distance. Here they're making, there's no law in the Torah to light a light. The answer to that, Rabbi Soloveitchik gave me, is that it is found in the Torah. Where is it found in the Torah? This is a trick question. It's not directly found in the Torah. In both cases, in Hanukkah and Purim, a miracle had occurred, which, you know, the Jews were threatened with the destruction, and a miracle occurred, and they were miraculously saved. So when we have precedent, what our obligation is, when miracles occur and God saves us, we see in the Torah itself that we're obligated to give praise, and thanksgiving to God. Where do we see that? By the Shira, by the splitting of the sea. Oz Yarshem Moshe, then Moses sang. So Moses sang a song of praise, which means that whenever God performs a miracle, there's an obligation to give praise. to publicize and to give praise. So this is just an extension of that. In both of these cases, the Jews were miraculously saved. So the rabbis ordained what we ought to do to give praise to God. So on Hanukkah, we light the light, and we recite the blessings. And on Purim, we recite the Megillah. So it's not something new. It's a Torah concept which is being applied to a particular case. All right. Now let me take up the subject matter that you should not detract from it. We understand why you can't add to it. And this is not an addition, by the way, because the rabbis make it very clear that this is not in the Torah, that this is something from the rabbis. If they came along, if the rabbis were to come along and say that the obligation to, for example, in the case of meat and milk, as I said, meat and milk biblically is very minimalistic. It's not that intrusive. Life would be more, you know, you wouldn't need two sets of dishes, and you could have butter at a meat meal. It's just, I don't want to get anybody upset. It's just, you just couldn't have McDonald's. You couldn't have a cheeseburger because, it's, according to the Torah, it was defined only when it's cooked together. But because what happens is one thing leads to another. And if we were to have meat and milk together all the time, so people wouldn't differentiate. It's only people that are on a very abstract level that can make these neat distinctions. You know, that's what happens. Once things break down, one thing leads to another. Anyway, that's the general rule. So it came to the point of absolute separation between meat and dairy. My point is, though, that if the rabbis were to come along when they did this and say, let's say in order to strengthen the position, because they didn't want people to rebel, and said that, no, this is what God said, that the Torah says that it's not just when you cook it together, but it's having it together at the same meal. If they were to say that, then they'd be in violation, because that would be considered adding. Then they're adding to the Torah. If somebody comes along and says that not drinking milk at the same meal with meat is part of that commandment, he's adding to the commandment, because that's not true. The commandment is only when the two are cooked together. So the rabbis came along and they acknowledged that. That's the commandment. We, in order to protect that, are making a fence. They have to make that clear. If they don't make that clear, and they try to present their legislation as though this is really what God was commanding, then they're in violation, because they're distorting God's word.
Okay, so where are they?
To take up now an interpretation by the Sforno. The Sforno is one of the classical biblical commentators. And he gives a brilliant interpretation as to explaining why Moshe has to say that you can't diminish. You can't add to it, okay, that's one thing. That's not so difficult, because let's say a person wants to keep the Torah, but he feels that the Torah is too lenient in certain areas, and it's important to be even more strict than God demanded, and he would want to add to the Torah, so that you have to know you can't do that. You can't add. Don't be more religious than God, so to speak. God, the way God established it, it's the perfect balance. The Torah system, the way God established it, is the perfect balance. So don't add to it. Okay. But what is the idea of the detracting, of diminishing, of taking away, of canceling? What are you going to cancel a mitzvah? What kind of person would have the thought that he can cancel a mitzvah? It comes from God. So what's the mentality behind that? He gives a brilliant explanation. And I'm going to quote to you from the Sforno. He says, and you should not subtract from it. That is, he says, that a person, this thought should not enter into his mind. That, because many of the commandments of the Torah are based upon certain reasons. So he raises the issue, let's say God commanded us to refrain from something for a certain reason, and that became obsolete. The reason no longer applies. So if the reason no longer applies, you might think that there's no need to keep that mitzvah anymore. That, he says, and he gives an example. He gives an example from a great king of Israel who used this type of reasoning and was able to justify, to permit himself to do something which otherwise would be prohibited. Is anybody familiar with who I'm talking about? Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. And the Torah says, we're going to be taking it up in the next few weeks, about laws pertaining to a king, that a king cannot increase wives. See, he's permitted to have more than, we're talking in a context where men can have more than one wife. So basically, how many can a man have? Well, there's no limitation in terms of number. But the king was limited. The king could not have more than 18 wives. And it says, but the reason is given, that they should not sway his heart. That he should not, well, basically it means to say that he should not marry the kind of people who might sway his heart to go away from following the Torah. So he, the way he interpreted the law, Shlomo HaMelech interpreted the law, that it didn't apply to him, because he was on a level where he could not be swayed. And he did marry, he arranged a lot of marriages, he married the daughter of Paro from Egypt, a lot of them had political implications. And it turned out that this was a mistake, because even though they had converted to Judaism, but still, they came from an idolatrous background. And it became a source of a big problem, because they insisted they wanted to have certain houses of worship for idolatry and so on and so forth. And when he got older, the Tanakh says, when Shlomo HaMelech got older, they were able to affect him, and he sort of gave in to them. He made certain concessions to them. It wasn't good for the Jewish people. So it turns out that he made a mistake, because he reasoned that the reason of that command didn't apply to him. That he had reached a level where he could not be swayed by marrying women to depart from keeping the mitzvot. And it turned out he was wrong. He was swayed. So Sforno is using that as an example. So you might think, when you study certain mitzvot and you discover what the reasons are, and you might say that those reasons don't really apply anymore. So if the reason doesn't apply, I shouldn't have to keep it anymore. That's what Moshe is saying. Do not. Do not make that. That would be a very serious mistake. See, now I've answered my question to a certain extent, because my question was, does this person believe it comes from God, or doesn't he? If he believes it comes from God, so how can he stop keeping certain mitzvot? Sforno is saying, yeah, it's a rational person. Moshe Rabbeinu over here is talking to a rational person who believes that it comes from God, and he studies the mitzvot, and he may discover that certain mitzvot, the reason, they were given for a certain reason, and that reason may not apply anymore. So therefore, you'll say there's no need to keep it anymore. He says that would be a big mistake. Now, I want to see if we can understand that on a bit of a deeper level. For example, he uses the case of Shlomo, who knew the reason, and he said the reason doesn't apply. So he didn't keep the mitzvah. And unfortunately, it turned out that he was wrong, and it was a big error on his part. It had bad consequences. Yeah, but let me ask you a question. All right, but suppose Shlomo, according to this, it's only because it didn't work out. But suppose Shlomo would have married those women and they wouldn't have affected him. So would the case be any different? He seems to be saying, well, look at Shlomo. Yeah, all right, so let's say that so Shlomo made a mistake. But let's say Shlomo would not have given in to that urge, and let's say he would have married these women and he would have refused all their requests and they would not have swayed his heart. Would that make the point any differently? Would that? What's the point? There's got to be a universal point over here. And I think it takes us to the heart of this issue. Can a mitzvah become obsolete? Because he did say, the Torah gave a reason for that commandment. The Torah said, do not, for example, it says he should not increase horses. There's a few things he can't increase. Because in those days, horses came from Egypt. So the Torah commands us never to go back to Egypt. That Jews are permitted to settle anywhere in the world. I mean, when there's a Jewish state, we should be living in Israel. But outside of Israel, there's no prohibition except that we're not permitted to reside in the land of Egypt. I know there was communities of Jews historically that did live. That was, I guess, because of circumstances. They had no choice. But other than that, today, for example, this is in effect today. That if a person goes to Egypt today, you can go there to visit as a tourist, or you can go there to do business. But you can't go there and reside there to say, this is my residence. That would be a violation. That command is still in effect. So the prohibition of the king to increase horses was because lest he take the nation back to, he bring people back to Egypt, because that was the source. They used to, the best Egyptian steeds. Egypt was the breeding ground for horses. So, and that's an interesting, he doesn't use that as an example, but would that be in effect today if we had a Jewish king If we had a Jewish king today, and for whatever reason, we don't use horses today. The horses, of course, then was used mainly for military power. But today, obviously, nobody uses horses for military power. Unless it's some kind of a third or fourth world nation, but, you know, it's not going to get you very far, even there, right? So, let's say we had, as a good example, let's say we had a king today, and he liked horses, and he wanted to increase horses, and gather, you know, a tremendous stable of horses from all over the world. So you might say, well, it's not in effect anymore. First of all, Egypt is not the center of horses. Let's say that changed. I assume that that's not the case. Let's assume that the center of horses became some place in South America. Where did it happen? Thus, we have to see if we can understand the point over here. And not only that, it's interesting. Let me show you another example. There are many commandments of the Torah that seem incomprehensible, that people have a tough time finding a reason for. I'm sure you're all familiar with the idea that it's prohibited for a Jew to have a tattoo. Tattooing is very popular today. I guess it was always popular, but today it's like an art form. People have sometimes their whole bodies are covered with tattoos. Everybody knows that the Torah prohibits tattoos. But why? What's wrong with a tattoo? If somebody asked you that question, I think it might be hard put to explain. Not everybody knows the explanation. The Rambam and the Guide for the Perplexed. He said that many of the... He has a section, the reasons for the commandments. So he made a study of what the reasons are of the mitzvos. And he said many of the commandments of the Torah were inexplicable to him, could not figure out the reason, until he made a study. Because he said the ultimate purpose, the main purpose of the entire Torah is to uproot all forms of idolatry. That's the worst crime in the Torah, is to uproot idolatry. And if you understand primitive idolatry and ancient idolatry, what the practices of the idolaters were, then many mitzvos of the Torah, which you otherwise could not understand, will become clear to you. For example, he maintains, that's his interpretation, that not wearing wool and linen together traces back to forms of idolatry, where they used to use two different types of species and bring it together and their clothing and so on and so forth, and as part of a pagan worship rite, and the Torah came to uproot it. He says the same thing, by the way, about the tattoos. So that's the answer that you're saying. The Rambam says that the Torah prohibited tattoos. This is also by the Chinuch, the Sefer HaChinuch, because in ancient times, these pagan cults, the people would have these seals. They'd have certain kind of seals on their body as a sign that they belong, so to speak, to this deity. So that would be a sign that the worshippers employed. So therefore, it's a form of idolatry, and we can't copy the idolaters. And even though you may be doing some kind of picture of a butterfly or some type of an innocuous thing, you know, or some kind of phrase, "I love mom," whatever it is, you may be doing that, which has nothing to do with idolatry. It doesn't matter, because the Torah uprooted the entire practice, lest it lead an individual to idolatry. The point I'm making, for example, the Sforno has a different reason for tattoos, which corresponds to what some of the women said here tonight. Listen to this. He says that you can't have a tattoo because you're not allowed to put any sign on your flesh, with the exception of the sign of the covenant, the bris. He's saying it's God, it's pretty much connected, that the bris milah, the circumcision, we say it in the Birkat HaMazon, that's the covenant that you've inscribed in our flesh. So that's a sign of the covenant.
You're inscribing something in the flesh.
That is to say that the circumcision is supposed to serve as a sign. It's an oath, it's a sign. And basically it means to say that we are servants of God. That's the meaning, that we enter into a covenant with God. And the entire purpose of our physical existence is in the flesh. The entire purpose of physical existence is not just for sensual gratification, but as a means of serving God, of attaining holiness. So therefore, it has to. It only functions as a sign if there's nothing. You put some other sign, it contradicts the first sign. You see, by putting in a tattoo with a different. Every tattoo has a certain message. That's true. That is true. Women don't, but you have to understand what he means. It's because of this fact that you have to know how laws work. God wanted this law to be accepted by the Jewish people. The law was given to the Jewish people. And therefore the law prohibits anybody and everybody. Again, you can't differentiate that this person can't want to, this person can have and this person can't. The reason for it, however, is because it's God's will that the Jewish nation should have a sign, one sign. And of course, that's expressed in the men. There are other things that are expressed in the women, but it's part of the nation. That this nation expresses in its flesh that they're part of the covenant. So it only applies to men, obviously, but it's for the entire nation. And therefore, for women to have a tattoo would be just as much a breach, because it would be negating. It would be negating the fact that we only have one sign in the flesh, and that's the circumcision. All right, so it's only in men, but it applies to the whole nation. See, the reason I'm going into this is because you might say that, according to the Rambam maintained that God ordained many laws in the Torah, and he could only understand them when he found out about these ancient cults. So you might say that once those cults are gone, so what's the relevance of the mitzvah? According to that reasoning, that the idolaters, the pagans, used to inscribe them, their bodies with tattoos as an indication of, you know, that they're connected to the deity. So if that doesn't exist anymore, so then you would say, perhaps, that now there should be no reason to prohibit a tattoo. So that's what he's coming to tell you. That is a faulty approach to mitzvahs. That Let's analyze for a second the mistake that Shlomo made. Shlomo made a mistake. And even though you're right, we can detect the Torah is a divine system. It's based upon God's infinite knowledge. But still, God gave us a mind. And God gave us the ability to discover certain purposes in the mitzvah. It's a purpose. But if you make the mistake of thinking that you've exhausted everything there is, just because you've discovered one aspect, one purpose. And there's another mistake over here too, in the mistake of Shlomo, in that you can see, he made a mistake about his own nature. The Torah is based upon the most profound insight into man's deeper nature. So therefore, when the Torah says that don't do this, because if you do this, it can lead to something else. Now sometimes you have a certain sense of confidence, I don't need that. Like for example, the Torah prohibits yichud. Yichud means seclusion. You know, there's laws where you can't be secluded with another man, or a man can't be secluded with a strange, so to speak, woman, not his wife.
It's like two men.
Yeah, there's all kinds of precautions, but a lot of times a person will feel, I don't need that. That's for ordinary people. But I'm on such a plane, I can't be tempted. There's no real need for it. What the Torah is telling us is that God looked into the deeper recesses of human nature, and we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that we have that total understanding. No matter how well analyzed you are, no matter how you've progressed, you can't overestimate your own nature, and a person always has to operate with a certain degree of caution. And Shlomo HaMelech made that mistake because he thought he really knew his own nature, and I'm sure he did know his own nature. But when it came to this matter, he was mistaken about himself. And that things could change. And let me just conclude the point. So this is how he ties it in. If you remember, I raised the question. So Moshe goes on to say, remember what happened in the case of Baal Peor. You saw with your own eyes what took place in Baal Peor. For every man that went after Baal Peor, that was the idol, the Lord your God destroyed from your midst. So the question, of course, is what does one thing have to do with the other? He's telling us not to detract, not to overestimate yourself, and not to think that you understand what this mitzvah is for, and really it's not necessary anymore, because you can be very mistaken. You have to be very cautious. A lot of times you give in to a certain temptation, believing that it's not going to have any effect upon you, and before you know it, it did have an effect upon you, and you're not the same person you were before. That's why the Torah does believe in precautions. Precautions not to mingle, not to go to certain places, and not to, get involved in certain types of socializations, and have a few drinks, and be thinking it's harmless. It's not so harmless because there's very powerful forces within you, deep psychological unconscious forces within you that you're not completely in control of and not even aware of. And before you know it, the person says, I don't know what happened to me. It just happened. I was just having some laughs, this and that, and I don't know, I just did something crazy. And they really believe that, but it's not the case. A person unconsciously, generally speaking, a person doesn't get into a situation in which they do these kind of crazy things unless, on an unconscious level, they wanted to do some crazy things already. But they couldn't acknowledge that they needed these precautions. They believe that they are completely in control. They could control all their emotions. Very important point over here. So the Sforno explains brilliantly, what took place in the matter of Baal Peor? That's the where they seduced the men. What was their eitzah? What was their strategy? They really wanted to get the Jews involved in idol worship because they knew that the essence of the Jewish uniqueness is that they renounce idolatry. And once that was his idea, that once the Jews get involved in idolatry, then God will punish them. But how are you going to get them involved in idolatry? That's one of the if you're going to try a frontal assault head on, the Jews are going to resist. So they got them involved in a different thing, the seduction, the sexual, the mingling, the socializing. And he says the men that gave into that, they were very intelligent people. And they never would have believed that they would ever possibly be dragged into this. It was a primitive form of idolatry, of paganism. Baal Peor was the kind of thing people would regard as disgusting. So these men, all right, so they decided to... It was wrong, but they thought they were getting involved just in the sexual fling, and that's it. And before you know it, once they were involved, they became ensnared, they became entrapped, and then the women demanded that if you want to be with me, then you have to join with me and go to church with me and all of that, and they were ensnared. So they made that mistake. They made that mistake of thinking that they were smart enough, that they were smarter than God's Torah. That's the connection over here. And Va'atem Advekim... But those of you who clung to God, that means that even though you may have had temptations, but you knew that God said, and that, by the way, that's the reason for intermarriage. That's what the Torah says. The reason is because when you marry people from different religions, so then it's inevitable. You're going to embrace that religion. You're going to embrace that culture. You're going to embrace that idea. It'll take you away from God. That's the idea that's being expressed over here, that there's a proper way that a person should approach the Torah. And as you mentioned before, with a certain humbleness, with a certain humility, with a respect for the fact that the Torah is a reflection of God's infinite wisdom. So even in a case like tattooing, and even if we should say like the Rambam, that it's based upon what ancient cults used to do, and even if it should be that they don't exist anymore, and you would say, well, there's no reason today. No. The Rambam would say you must keep it. Because every mitzvah is based upon profound ideas and insights into the way people function, insights into your own nature. And it's true, you may have discovered one aspect of it, but there's, as we've seen, aside from that, even if you should discount that factor of idolatry, but look at the philosophy that's tied in with tattooing, that people are involved in narcissism and worship of the body and making the body into the essence, instead of realizing that the body is an instrument that God gave us and we should use it to elevate ourselves and to serve God. All these things have an effect. When a person goes down that path and lives that kind of life, you see they become totally wrapped up in their own fantasy world, their own illusions, their own love of themselves, and it's all based upon very superficial things. Superficial phenomena, the type of design that I have, my clothing, my superficialities. So again, the Torah, you see, it's more than just one thing. The Torah is directing us away from completely being immersed in the externals and the superficialities. And we're not negating that, we're not ascetics, but towards a recognition that everything comes from God. And God gave us these things to use for a purpose, to serve Him, to elevate ourselves. So that's the point over here, that a person should always have the proper attitude towards Torah and study the Torah humbly. And the more you study, even things that at a certain point in your life you can't figure out what the rhyme is, what the reason is, but then you should say, well, that's my limitation. And hopefully as I study more, I'll open up more wisdom and knowledge. The Torah is a source of infinite wisdom and knowledge, and therefore it's not subject to any type of manipulation, either by addition or subtraction. While we're on the subject of tattooing is not where it's superficial. It's got to be something which is pierced
but
into
the
skin.
Idea for them that I have a
as far as children having these superficial tattoos, where it's just painted on and then you can wash it off?
Actually, you can take scotch tape and peel it off.
You can peel it off. Well, that's not really a violation of a tattoo. So the mitzvah of chinuch, of teaching, the mitzvah of teaching a child is in accordance with what the Torah. So the Torah does not prohibit that. The definition of a tattoo is when it has two things. It has to have the ink, and the ink has to be injected
right.
in.
That's
as far as Mara Zion is concerned, that's a serious category. Doing something which is permitted, but it appears, has the appearance of a sin. That's very important. But once it becomes known, for example, when they first came out with the power of milk,
I would have put it in coffee.
So then, for coffee, at a meat meal, so then you had to have the container on the table so everybody could see.
And the tofutti ice cream.
Exactly, and the ice creams and so on and so forth. Today, you don't have to have any of these things because it's a well-known thing that they have all these parva, non-dairy products.
Known, you know.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
okay. For the next 2 weeks, I'm out of town. So I think maybe we'll reconnect in September or something. We'll have a discussion as to what we're going to do. Thank you.